Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
The Las Vegas Shooting, An Our Age of Anger by Jeffrey Kluger. Anger is one of humanity's elemental particles. It's small, unstable, simple to the point of crude, and yet, in the right densities and balances, it's fundamental to who we are. Lately, in America at least, that balance has been wildly off. Nobody was responsible for the slaughter in Las Vegas on October 1st except the monster who pulled the trigger. Not policymakers in Washington, not anger stokers on cable TV, not even the gunmakers who manufactured the instruments that made the carnage possible. The killer did the killing. Period. But that killing came in a context, and that context is anger. Americans have made something of a fetish of our rage of late. In fact, that's even been leaking into our language. The base is never just animated, it's always enraged. Healthcare debates are never spirited, they're always furious. In the run-up to the 2016 election, a CNN/ORC poll found that 69% of Americans reported being either very or somewhat angry at the state of the nation. That showed itself in a kind of rage voting on both sides of the political divide. Trump! Bernie, take that! The way the internet and cable news work, outrage over any event can be mustered easily, says David Pizarro, a professor of psychology at Cornell University. We feel those emotions strongly in ways we didn't used to. Michael Kimmel, a professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University in New York, refers to this kind of rage as aggrieved entitlement, the kind of luxury anger a culture can allow itself when its basic needs, like food and shelter, are met. Still, ambient anger can become a culture's dry leaves, kindling, lying everywhere that's utterly harmless, but only until it meets an errant spark and a good gust of wind. Mental illness may be the spark. As for the wind, rage, or worse, contempt, can be more than enough, especially in the case of racially or politically motivated killings like Charlottesville or the Charleston church shooting. We are increasingly dividing ourselves into in-groups and out-groups, says Pizarro. Anger and contempt can cause you to see the other group as less than your own, even less human. Non-humans, of course, become easier to kill. Worse, rage easily becomes a contagion, with the emotion passing from one person to the next with the ease of a virus. Social norms play incredibly important roles in shaping our behavior, says Linda Tropp, professor of social psychology in the Psychology of Peace and Violence program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We look to others in our social environment to learn whether to respond to events with violent or peaceful actions, with hatred or friendliness. Certainly, it's impossible to blame any one mass killing, including the Las Vegas slaughter, on any one set of social variables. Still, in the same way no single heat wave can be ascribed to climate change, but years of record-breaking temperatures point to a planet running a fever, so too does our increasing gun violence suggest a certain national soul sickness. From 1982 to 2011, mass shootings occurred in the U.S. about once every 173 days, an already horrific figure. Since then, such killings have happened more than three times as frequently, once every 58 days. That rising tide of blood isn't happening by itself. In a less combative political environment, reasonable people could agree on reasonable solutions to the gun scourge, or at the very least to study and treat the problem like the public health emergency it is. But the same spittle-flying fury that has us shouting past one another on cable news and talk radio prevents any rational debate in state legislatures or Congress. So the guns, an estimated 300 million of which are currently in circulation, continue to flow into the communities, where they mix with the rage which bumps into mental illness, and inevitably something blows. We live in a culture that doesn't like multivariate equations, says Kimmel, but there are a lot of variables at play here. Murder, of course, can never be reduced to math, but math does have something to say in all this. Change a factor on the left side of an equal sign and you get a different result on the right. Each of us is a part owner of our national anger, and each of us can play some small role in fixing that problem.
The Equifax hearing Monopoly Man speaks. Do the Monopoly Man a solid and call your senator. By Jennifer Kalfas. If you think you were mistaken when you saw the Monopoly Man at the Senate Banking Committee's hearing on the massive Equifax data breach Wednesday, you may need to adjust your monocle. Amanda Werner, arbitration campaign manager for Public Citizen and Americans for Financial Reform, caused quite a stir while dressed as Rich Uncle Pennybags and sitting directly behind former Equifax CEO Richard Smith. Playing the Monopoly Man who scrunched his eye to hold his monocle in place, twisted his white mustache, and dabbed his forehead with money, Werner channeled the board game figure to raise awareness about a key issue resulting from the credit bureau's massive data breach that compromised the personal information of more than 145 million people. Forced arbitration. Or, as Werner describes it, a get-out-of-jail-free card that forces consumers to waive their rights to a class-action lawsuit and leaves companies relatively unpunished. Werner, who uses the gender pronouns they, them, told Money they came up with the idea last week. We talked about doing this and trying to photobomb him, essentially, during the hearing, but I didn't actually think it was going to come together, Werner said. Werner did not realize the act would go viral until an intern for the organization stood in line at 7 a.m. and scored prime real estate for Werner directly behind Smith and other Equifax officials and in direct view of C-SPAN's cameras. I was getting a lot of dirty looks all throughout the hearing, especially when I would drop my monocle or crinkle a dollar bill, Werner said of the reactions Equifax officials had. Folks were really not happy with me. But those on social media had a different impression, and Werner's Monopoly Man blew up online. On Tuesday, the Monopoly Man made a less viral appearance as Werner stood outside the Senate Banking Committee's hearing and handed out get-out-of-jail-free cards to senators and Wells Fargo CEO Tim Sloan, who did not accept the gift. The cards were also delivered to each of the 100 Senate offices. Of course, the Monopoly Man's mission this week was not all fun and games. While the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau enacted a rule in July 2017 that would not allow companies to use forced arbitration, Senate leadership is examining ways to overturn it this fall. The Senate Banking Committee this week questioned current and former executives at Equifax and Wells Fargo, companies that have used forced arbitration, resulting in strong language from some committee members. Equifax tried to alleviate issues caused by the breach last month by offering a credit monitoring service that required forced arbitration. Senator Elizabeth Warren criticized Smith on Wednesday for using the breach to make millions of dollars. Warren and other senators were impressively professional throughout the hearing and did not react at all to Werner's getup, the activist said. Both these companies really show the damage that forced arbitration can cause, to leave consumers without a remedy in the face of massive misconduct, Werner told Money. Do the Monopoly Man a solid and call your senator, Werner added. But the cause for Monopoly Man is personal, too. Werner was one of the millions impacted by the credit bureau's data breach. This is an issue I care about and have been working on for a long time, but Equifax in particular is not my favorite company right now, Werner said. Still, Monopoly Man found humor in the protest. I'm glad that we were able to give folks a moment of levity in what's been a really hard week, Werner said. As for Rich Uncle Pennybags' future in Washington, D.C., keep an eye out. This is a hero that people will want to see again, Werner said. How to Parent Like a Scandinavian by Linda Akison McGurk. When I became a mom in the U.S., the parenting experience was nothing like I had expected. The playgrounds, which I thought would be teeming with children, were often deserted. Most young children seemed to be either glued to a screen at home or being drilled with academics at preschool. When I went outside for daily walks with my baby in the winter, people took pity on us and offered me rides. Meanwhile, in my native Sweden, kids gear up to go outside every day, regardless of the weather, both at home and at preschool. Forget flashcards, wall words, and kindergarten readiness. Scandinavian parents are keener to have their young children climb trees and dig for earthworms than learn academic facts. But this is far from the only surprising difference between the two parenting cultures. Let your baby nap outside all year. Most Scandinavian parents are so adamant about giving their infants and toddlers fresh air every day that they let them take their naps in prams outside. Yes, even in the winter and even in freezing temperatures. The advantage of this practice? Parents report that babies take longer and deeper naps when they sleep comfortably bundled up outside in the cold, and most felt the practice was healthy because of the fresh air, according to one Finnish study. Doctors also recommend it as a way to decrease children's exposure to germs and reduce the risk of infection. Don't obsess over gender. Nope, you won't find any gender reveal parties or other ceremonies revolving around the sex of a baby in Scandinavia. In fact, hospitals in Sweden typically won't share the sex of a baby even if they can see it during a sonogram, so most parents-to-be don't know what they're having until the day the baby is born. Parents feel strongly about treating boys and girls the same and are no stranger to protesting companies whose clothing or toys cement stereotypical gender roles. Some parents even choose to send their children to gender-neutral nursery schools, where the pedagogy specifically focuses on breaking with traditional gender roles. Don't use corporal punishment. Sweden was the first country in the world to ban spanking and all other forms of corporal punishment in 1979, and its neighbors, Finland and Norway, soon followed suit. Although spanking was once a common way to discipline your child, more and more parents voluntarily moved away from the practice in the 1960s, as the continuous growth of a democratic, egalitarian ideal meant that more and more Swedes felt that all people, children too, should enjoy equal protection from violence, according to the official side of Sweden. Today, using any type of physical discipline is a foreign concept to Scandinavian parents. Relax about nudity. Scandinavian parents encourage young kids to run around in their birthday suit outside when the temperature permits. Instead of thinking of nudity as something shameful, parents believe it's important for children to be knowledgeable about and feel comfortable with their own bodies. This belief is reflected in children's books, which sometimes sport anatomically correct illustrations of children with no clothes on. And when the Swedish Public Service TV launched a cartoon for preschoolers featuring a singing penis and vagina, called Willy and Twinkle in the English version, it quickly became a viral sensation, not because parents were outraged, but because most of them loved it. Encourage your kids to run wild and get dirty. Messy, wild play outdoors is seen as a perfectly natural, even cherished part of childhood in Scandinavian society, and parents welcome muddy boots, scraped knees, and piles of filthy clothes as proof that their children had a good day filled with adventure and exploration. Scandinavians happily forego both pocket-sized hand sanitizers and chlorine-infused toy cleaning routines, and don't panic if their charges happen to sample a clump of dirt. Recent studies suggest that they're onto something, as microbes in the soil may help kids and their immune systems become more resilient to allergies and asthma. The subjects of those studies? Americans.
Doris Huser's memory of the Route 91 Harvest Festival in Las Vegas is a sickening blur, punctuated by perfect still images, snapshots she will remember for the rest of her life. There is the image of the woman, her eyes vacant, lying on her back on the pavement in front of Hoosier. "I've been shot," Hoosier recalled her saying. There is the woman whose wheelchair had tipped over in the panic after what would become the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history began. Her body spilled onto the ground, and people were leaping over her, terrified, scrambling for the only exit. There is the image of Hoosier's 8-year-old daughter, Cordelia, vomiting uncontrollably into a cowboy hat, a reaction to the trauma, her aquamarine jeans stained black from the asphalt. But most of all, there is the memory, the mind-bending, stomach-wrenching terror of losing track of her 5-year-old son, Aiden, and her 25-year-old sister in the chaos that was unleashed when gunman Stephen Paddock killed at least 59 people and injured hundreds more. It was the worst feeling in the world, Hoosier told Time. For hours she couldn't find them. She couldn't reach them. She didn't know if they were alive or dead. And before all that, before the horror, there was joy. Hoosier, 29, who works as a model, loves country music. She had gone to 3 of the last 4 Route 91 Harvest Festivals. This time around, her husband Mike, who works in the poker room at the Aria Resort and Casino, had surprised her with tickets for her birthday in September. Hoosier decided to bring her kids and her sister Samantha Jewell, who has a developmental disability. It was supposed to be a celebration, an adventure, one of those extravagances that helps make a life well lived. Indeed, Sunday evening started with all the trappings of a good outdoor concert. Footlong corn dogs, funnel cake, ribs for Hoosier and her sister, and Dippin' Dots for the kids. It was the last day of the 3-day festival, and everyone was feeling giddy. A little after 9 p.m., before country music star Jason Aldean was scheduled to take the stage, Hoosier and her family claimed a spot in the center of the outdoor venue, in the shadow of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. They put down their food and drinks and set up camp. They wanted a good view, but they didn't want to be in the thrumming crowd way up close to the stage. So then, Jason Aldean comes on, and we start kind of rocking out, dancing, and having a good time, Hooser recalled. And Cordelia gives me that look. I have to go to the potty. Hooser told Aiden and Samantha they'd be right back and hustled her daughter over to the porta-potty area. She figured they'd be gone for 5 minutes, 10 at the most. But when they made their way back in through the fence, it was too late. A crackling sound, like fireworks, was already filling the air. I thought it was strange, Hooser said. Jason Aldean isn't the type to have pyrotechnics, and even if he did, it wouldn't be right at the beginning of the show. But these weren't fireworks. Things had gone haywire. People were running at Hooser and Cordelia, hunched, panicked, screaming. Someone yelled, "They're shooting, they're shooting." Hooser's stomach sank. She'd left Aiden and Samantha alone. Aiden is in kindergarten, and Samantha's abilities are close to those of a 9-year-old. Hooser pushed into the crowd against the flow. "Run," someone yelled at her. "Get her out of here," shouted another, pointing at Cordelia. But Hooser wouldn't turn around. Soon the sound of bullets was everywhere, the shuddering, rapid clapping of an automatic weapon, combined with the sound of metal ricocheting off of everything, asphalt, clothing, bodies. It was a hailstorm of bullets. But Hooser didn't react as she would have expected. People say that in a war, you get an instinct to stay down, to get cover, but I didn't have that instinct, Hooser said. All I had was, I have to find my son, I have to find my sister. Hooser held Cordelia's hand tight and pushed them towards where the bullets were coming from. It was mayhem. There were bodies everywhere. Some had been shot, some were bleeding, others were lying on top of each other. There were piles of people strewn all over. "Is he in there?" "No, next pile." "Is he in there?" "No, next pile," Hooser said. "We were looking for a shoe, a shirt we recognized." Bullets hit the pavement all around them, hit the canvas concession stands. Fellow concertgoers clawed at Hooser's boots, grabbed Cordelia by the legs. "Get down," they screamed. At some point, someone dragged Hooser and Cordelia to the asphalt. Hooser doesn't know who it was. They lay there for a moment, taking stock. Hooser remembers looking up and seeing bright flashes of white light coming from a window in the Mandalay Bay just a few blocks away. The flashes seemed to keep time with the rolling popping of the automatic gunfire. "I stared up at it for a second or two," she said. "I didn't put it together at the time, but I was looking right at him. I must have been looking right at him." Eventually, she and Cordelia got up and pushed forward again, further into the concert space, closer to where the family had claimed their spot. There was no one there. Aiden and Samantha were gone. A man came up behind Hooser, grabbed her by the belt, and threw Cordelia over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes. "Run," he told Hooser. "Run for your life." Hooser ran for the only exit, her legs burning, her heart pounding in her chest. When they got close, the man scooped Cordelia off his shoulder and disappeared. Hooser and Cordelia had made it. They were safe. It was then that Hooser lost it. She started screaming, "Aiden! Samantha!" Where had they gone? Had they been shot? Was her little boy alive? The next several hours played out in a slow-motion nightmare. An Uber driver took Hooser and Cordelia, free of charge, to the Aria, where Hooser's husband Mike works, but he was not on shift that night. When news of the attack reached the resort, the whole place was shut down. No one was allowed in or out, and Hooser's cell phone was dead. There was nothing she could do. She couldn't call her parents. She couldn't find her son. Cordelia began vomiting from the stress and trauma. She threw up for more than an hour, her tiny body convulsing with fear. At one point, a crowd of revelers who hadn't yet heard about the tragedy passed by, clapping and laughing. Cordelia burst into tears. "Mommy, they're shooting again," she screamed. Meanwhile, across town, a young woman, an everyday angel of some kind, found Aiden alone and terrified. Her name is Lindsay Rogers. She is 26. She had run to a merchandise tent and found the 5-year-old boy who had fallen and been separated from his aunt. Rogers took a picture of Aiden on her phone and posted it to social media. "Whose child is this?" It was shared 500 times. A few hours later, Hoosier's father got a call from Sunrise Hospital, the trauma center nearest the Las Vegas Strip. They had Aiden. Another Good Samaritan helped Samantha make it to a nearby Hooters. Hoosier's father drove down from his house to collect them both. When he got to the hospital, Aiden was sitting alone on a stretcher. When he got to Hooters, the elevator upstairs was coated in blood. The next morning, Hoosier and Cordelia went to Hoosier's parents' house. The gratitude, the enormous gratitude. But now, Hoosier warns, the real work begins. Both Cordelia and Aiden have experienced significant trauma. I told them, "We've been through a war. Now is the time. We have to be here for each other," she said. On Monday night, she scooped them both up before bed. "If you want to cuddle up together, that's fine. You have to talk to each other, love each other." For Cordelia, the problem is loud noises. If anything claps or pops, she bursts into tears. And when she goes to sleep, she sees images of death and blood. She feels the terror in her dreams. For Aiden, it's the fear of being left alone. On Monday afternoon, out of the blue, when the family had gone to the store to buy groceries, Aiden stopped in his tracks. "Mom," he said, "next time, let's all go to the bathroom together." For Hoosier, the battle now is to model resilience and strength for her children. "I don't want them to grow up and be afraid to go to festivals, to go into crowds," she said. "I know they'll never be the same as they were on Saturday night. I know seeing something so terrible will be like taking a chunk of their childhoods, but I want them to have no worries. I want them to be fun-loving little kids again. That's my greatest hope."
Spain's Catalonia crisis is getting so serious that even the king weighed in. By Eli Mexler. Spain's King Felipe VI weighed in on the country's growing political crisis Tuesday, slamming what he called the irresponsible leaders who pushed for Catalonia's independence referendum as hundreds of thousands took to the streets to protest police violence at polling stations. The 49-year-old monarch, who rarely comments on the country's politics, criticized pro-secession leaders as a threat to Spain's democratic stability with Sunday's referendum, which passed with 90% of the 2.3 million votes cast, according to the Associated Press, with turnout less than 50%. "Today, Catalan society is fractured and in conflict," the king said. "They have infringed the system of legally approved rules with their decisions, showing an unacceptable disloyalty towards the powers of the state," he added, emphasizing the importance of preserving Spain's national unity. Sunday's referendum was met with violence from Spanish police, who fired rubber bullets and injured more than 900. On Tuesday, workers' unions held strikes and 700,000 demonstrators took to the streets of Barcelona, AP reports. Catalonian President Carles Puigdemont is expected to make a statement at 9 p.m. local time, Reuters reported. He had previously announced plans to declare independence in the days following the referendum. Catalonia, Spain's richest region, with its own distinct language and traditions, has long held that it contributes more to Spain's economy than it receives in return, about one-fifth of the GDP. A symbolic referendum in 2014 also passed with overwhelming support, but was poorly attended. Sexual assault survivor to Betsy DeVos, "Mediation is not a viable resolution." By Grace Watkins. Until my sophomore year, the University of Notre Dame held a special mass for those affected by sexual violence on campus called the Mass of Healing. The university explicitly invited the accusers, the accused, and their friends and family to a service where survivors had the option to receive the anointing of the sick, a last rites practice meant to bring strength during an illness. Although it was marketed to survivors of sexual violence like myself, I never went. I got the distinct sense it was not for us, Rather, the mass seemed like part of an attempt by the university to encourage their survivors to forgive their assailant. If Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has her way, more survivors will be pressured into forgiving their rapists. Last month, DeVos announced that the Department of Education would change the Obama administration's guidelines on how colleges should adjudicate sexual assault, seeking public feedback to replace the current approach with a workable, effective, and fair system. Then, on September 22nd, DeVos revoked the Obama administration's Title IX guidance about student survivors' rights on campus and issued interim guidance that allows schools to resolve sexual violence complaints through mediation if both parties agree to the process. In mediation, both the complainant and respondent would meet with an independent third party and have a conversation about what happened, with the goal of reaching some sort of resolution. The process is usually confidential and rarely results in punishment, even if the alleged perpetrator admits guilt. Guidance from both the Bush administration and Obama administration said mediation was not an appropriate method to resolve sexual assault complaints. After all, some feared that survivors would be pressured to opt for mediation over a formal investigation. Others worry that some schools would describe sexual violence as a mere dispute between students and encourage survivors to work it out with their rapists, not considering the further trauma such a meeting could cause. I am deeply worried that allowing mediation as a resolution to all forms of sexual violence at schools' discretion will result in schools pressuring survivors to participate. Schools that are not concerned with survivors' best interests are likely to prefer mediation to the standard Title IX investigation process. After all, mediation is easier for them because it requires far less manpower and time. Suspension and expulsion and the subsequent loss of tuition are unlikely to occur, and the confidential nature of the process makes a survivor less likely to come forward publicly with his or her allegations, allowing colleges and universities to avoid damage to their reputation. The previous two administrations were correct that mediation is inappropriate to resolving sexual assault allegations. Mediation is commonly and appropriately used in school settings when two students have a conflict that they both share some blame for, such as two roommates who have a dispute over their living arrangements. But it's wholly inappropriate when only one person is at fault. There's no shared blame in sexual assault. Survivors of sexual violence should not be asked to compromise, self-reflect, or reconcile relationships with someone that assaulted them. Even worse, mediation perpetuates the myth that sexual assault is simply a misunderstanding between two people, rather than what it really is, a violent abuse of power. Mediation fetishizes compromise, which for survivors often means premature forgiveness of serious harm. It relies on the societal expectation that good girls forgive, thereby reifying the same gender stereotypes that Title IX was intended to eliminate. Survivors deserve a trauma-informed process that protects them from further harm and respects their autonomy. It's alarming that the Department of Education lifted the ban on mediation without offering any guidance on how schools should conduct such a proceeding to assure that both parties receive due process and that survivors aren't further traumatized by the experience. Due to the lack of clear standards, the quality of mediation proceedings across college campuses is likely to widely vary based on whoever's leading the process. This state of affairs is deeply concerning, as mediation's open structure can make it highly susceptible to abuse. In cases of intimate partner violence, mediation could allow abusive partners to use the same tactics of manipulation and intimidation present in their relationship to dictate the terms of the resolution. It is all the more important that we be wary of these alternatives to Title IX investigations as the Department of Education rolls back enforcement. Universities will act in their best interest, which they have interpreted over and over again as mitigating risk instead of supporting individuals who experience sexual misconduct on their campus. Mediation presents a much easier and quicker way for administrators to resolve incidents on campus, thereby bypassing the need for investigations and additional staff hires. Some administrators may genuinely feel mediation serves survivors, but there are undeniable pecuniary interests at hand, and they go a long way to explaining why universities might prefer mediation over costlier but frequently requested measures like tuition remission for semesters in which abuse occurred and free long-term counseling for survivors. In the meantime, survivors shouldn't be guilted into accepting programs like mediation that don't meet their needs. When an option is convenient for universities, it's appropriate to be deeply skeptical. When this option capitalizes on gendered expectations of forgiveness and runs the risk of violating students' rights, it is appropriate for survivors to reject it altogether. Grace Watkins is a 2017 graduate of Notre Dame. "I love my guns, but I'm getting rid of my semi-automatic battle rifle," by James Bridgeforth. Bridgeforth lives in Jackson, Mississippi, and hunts on his family's land in Yazoo County. On the issue of gun control or reform, there should be some middle ground. Gun owners and Second Amendment supporters need to give some, as do anti-gun folks. Civilians should not be able to own military-style weapons. I do believe Americans should have the right to own weapons for home self-defense and for hunting, but there are too many weapons available to civilians that were originally designed for the battlefield. And as Las Vegas shows, once again, there are too many Americans willing to turn civilian life into a battlefield. I think what worries some gun owners is who decides what's military and what is for sport. I am deciding for myself. My action may not change anything, but the truth is, if my semi-automatic battle rifle were stolen or fell into the wrong hands, it would be devastating. So, to put my money where my mouth is, I'm getting rid of mine and donating it to a law enforcement agency. The gun I'm getting rid of is called an M1A Springfield Scout, or civilian M14. It shoots a .308 or .762-51 NATO. It's a semi-automatic and can send bullets 1,000 yards, 700 accurately, as fast as I can pull the trigger. It has a 10 and 20 round clip. You could probably get an even bigger one. It was designed for the military in the mid-1950s and is still used by special forces. It's much more powerful and accurate than an AR-15 or an AK-47. I purchased it because it's a great gun, and the truth is, I'm still a boy at heart, and mine too. I convinced myself I needed it because, hey, there are a lot of crazy people with weapons out there that I may need to defend myself from. I also told myself I needed to kill wild hogs. I've only seen wild hogs once. I've used the rifle to hunt deer, but I have a bolt-action rifle for the same purpose, which is all anyone needs for deer hunting. After the shooting happened in Las Vegas and the details began to come out, I knew this man had to have a weapon like mine. I know I don't need this rifle, and neither does anyone else. Selling it would be hypocritical because it would go back into gun circulation. I plan to give mine to the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks, the game wardens in my state. It's a very expensive gun. It cost me $1,300, not counting the scope, so this is not a particularly easy thing to do. But it will mean I'm not part of the problem, at least in my mind. My plan is to put any tax write-off towards charitable giving. I will keep my other guns for hunting and self-defense. Some people will say I've overreacted, others will say I haven't gone far enough. Getting rid of and eventually banning assault rifles and other military-style guns will not end the violence, but it will help. The shocking law that protects gun makers after mass shootings like Las Vegas, by Sean Gregory. There were some 22,000 people in the crowd at the Route 91 Harvest Festival in Las Vegas Sunday night when the gunman started firing. By the time police reached Stephen Paddock's sniper's perch on the 32nd floor of the nearby Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino, more than 500 people had been injured and at least 59 were killed, making it the deadliest mass shooting in recent U.S. history. As law enforcement works to understand how and why this could have happened, a central question for those directly affected will be what, if any, legal recourse do they have? While legal experts say there are a range of entities who could find themselves liable, including the estate of the gunman himself, one group is all but off limits, the manufacturers of the weapons used in the attack. The reason is a tangled web of lawsuits, legislation, and lobbying. Starting in the 1980s, plaintiffs began to file civil claims against gun manufacturers and retail stores after violent incidents, winning some notable victories. In 1997, for example, the Florida Supreme Court upheld a jury verdict that found Kmart liable for selling a gun to an intoxicated person who later shot his girlfriend, leaving her permanently quadriplegic. According to Timothy Lighton, a professor of law at Georgia State University and editor of the book Suing the Gun Industry, over 30 municipalities and the state of New York filed suits against the firearms industry to recoup costs of emergency personnel responding to shooting incidents. In 2000, Smith & Wesson reached a settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Treasury Department, in which the gun maker promised to implement safety enhancements. All firearms are subject to a drop test to ensure they don't go off when dropped, and follow a code of conduct in its sales and distribution practices. Manufacturers sell only to authorized dealers, make gun show sales only after the buyer completes a background check. This flurry of litigation coincided with the 1998 tobacco settlement agreement, in which the four biggest tobacco companies agreed to pay $206 million over 25 years to the states. The settlement spooked gun manufacturers, who feared they could be vulnerable to a similar coordinated legal assault. As a result, they leaned on Congress for insulation. The industry didn't just want to win cases, says Heidi Lee Feldman, a professor of law at Georgetown University. They wanted to make it impossible for them to be held accountable through tort litigation. In 2005, the firearms industry won what remains one of its most important legal victories, the passage, under a Republican-controlled Congress, of the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, or PLCAA. In effect, the act shields gun manufacturers and sellers from civil claims brought by victims of gun violence. It's shocking that this law exists, says Avery Gardner, co-president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, which advocates for stronger restrictions on guns. We need to ask ourselves, why should special provisions be given to the gun industry? Wayne LaPierre, the longtime head of the National Rifle Association, said at the time of its passage that the law was necessary to keep the firearms industry solvent and called it the most significant piece of pro-gun legislation in 20 years. There are some exemptions under PLCAA. If a defective product causes death or injury, or a manufacturer or dealer violates state or federal law in the sale or marketing of a product, plaintiffs can bring a suit. The most critical exemption that has been tested in court is the common law concept of negligent entrustment. The idea is that a gun can't be sold to a person if the seller knows, or reasonably should know, that the buyer poses an unusually high risk of misusing the weapon. That exemption was at the heart of a 2015 case in Milwaukee, when a civil jury awarded $5 million to two police officers shot by a teen. Jurors found a gun shop negligent for selling the gun to a straw purchaser who passed the firearm to a person too young to legally own a gun. The case was ultimately settled for $1 million. On a federal form, the buyer indicated he was purchasing the gun for someone else. On the state form, he said he was buying it for himself. That discrepancy, the court found, should have aroused reasonable suspicion and stopped the sale. In another case last year, Odessa Gun and Pawn in Missouri reached a $2.2 million settlement with a woman who claimed the store was negligent in selling a firearm to her mentally ill adult daughter, who shot and killed her father. Defense attorneys tried to get the case dismissed based on PLCAA. The Missouri Supreme Court permitted it to proceed. Collecting damages from gun manufacturers, however, is significantly harder under PLCAA than proving retailers negligent. That's because negligent entrustment tends to apply to one-on-one interaction. You need that personal relationship, says Patrick Dunphy, a plaintiff's attorney who worked on the Milwaukee police case. Manufacturers rarely sell guns straight to consumers off the factory floor. After the Sandy Hook school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, some families of the victims tried to extend the negligent entrustment exemption to manufacturers, filing a civil suit against Remington Outdoor Company, the maker of the rifle used in the massacre, as well as against the dealer and the owner of the store in which the shooter's mother purchased the assault rifle. The families argue that manufacturers should know marketing a weapon originally designed for combat to the general public creates an unreasonable risk that the weapon will be misused. The plaintiffs tried to analogize individual interaction to the collective situation, says Feldman. A judge dismissed the case last October, citing PLCAA. The case is under appeal. Victims in Las Vegas will be up against similar legal constraints. No plaintiff has ever prevailed in any of these lawsuits against gun manufacturers, says Leighton. Stephen Paddock, the man police identified as the shooter, reportedly had 23 firearms in his hotel room, and officials found 19 more at his house. Two Nevada gun shops confirmed Monday that they sold firearms to Paddock in the last year. They said he passed all background checks, though it's unknown if he used those specific firearms in the Las Vegas massacre. For supporters of stronger firearms restrictions, repealing PLCAA is a priority. If you significantly take away access to the courts, you take away a tool in the toolbox to make sure companies conform to social norms, says Gardner. When a company does something that has a negative effect on everyone else, we want them to be forced to pay for it. Dunphy, the Wisconsin attorney, isn't so hopeful. If Sandy Hook didn't result in legislation that either eliminated or restricted the type of guns that can be sold, or the people to whom they can be sold, nothing will ever change, he says. When someone slaughtering kids in a grade school isn't enough, what is?
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.